Okay. All right, tonight is the 36th in the series of the death of Shaul. If you recall, we haven't met in a long time, but if you recall, we ended on a number of cliffhangers. I hope the suspense didn't trouble anyone that much. Shaul HaMelech was told. Shaul HaMelech was told through Nevuah at Engdor that he would die in the battle with the Plishtim, which is about to commence. The Plishtim are poised to attack. Meanwhile, David, after the second uneasy reconciliation with Shaul, returned to Achish Melech Gath, to the Plishtim, and this time he was accepted by Achish. Not only accepted, but David enlisted in the service of Achish, first as a raider of tribes. David pretended to be killing Jews. In fact, he was killing the Knanim, seizing their property, giving it to Achish. Achish thought he had turned on Shaul and Klal Yisrael, so he brought him in as an official bodyguard, as his own security for Achish. And now it's literally crunch time. The Achish has said he wants to wage full-scale open war against Israel. So that's how he left it. Will David agree and go to war against his own people and the king who betrayed him? Or will he fight against the Jews and kill them, and or possibly be killed himself? Will his cover be blown and Achish will realize, in fact, that David had never really gone against Israel and supported the Plishtim? And then Achish will kill him instead. So, that's where we are now. Fortunately, we'll get to the answer right away. All the stories we'll mention tonight, really three separate incidents, are the hachana, the final preparations for David's assumption of Malchus. So let's see what happens. Look at number one, beginning today in the Perek Chavtes of Shmuel Aleph. Vayikvitzu plishtim es kol machane mafeko. The plishtim gathered their entire army to Afek. They're fighting in central Israel. V'yisrael chonim ba'ayin asher b'Yisrael. Right in the middle of the country. The Sarnei Plishtim Ovrim, the governors of the Plishtim, these are really the leading generals. L'me'os v'la'alafim, or ruling companies of thousands and hundreds. So this is the upper echelon, the chiefs of staff. The David v'anashav Ovrim b'achronoi m'achish. So they're at up front, marching, and David is in back with Achish, having assumed the responsibility for Achish's personal protection. Vayamrus Sarei Plishtim, the officers of the Plishtim said to the king, Mo ha'ivrim ha'ele, what are these Hebrews doing here? Vayomer Achish al Sarei Plishtim, Achish said to them, Halo zeh David, Eved Shaul, this is David, Shaul's servant, Melech Yisrael, Asher hayo iti zeh yomim al zeh shanim, he's with me now for months. V'lo matzasi v'o me'uma, I haven't found anything wrong with him. Miyom naflo adayom azeh, from the time he camped with us until today. So Achish says to the Plishtim, what is your problem? David is very faithful to me. Vayikfitzu alav sarei Plishtim vayom ruo. So the officers literally jumped on Achish. Ketzef here means anger. They were angry. Vayom ruo sarei Plishtim hashe v'soish. Send this person back, and let him return to the place that you assigned him. We don't want him coming down to battle with us. Let him not be an antagonist, an adversary to us in the battle. And they raise two objections, three really, but two come out of these psukim. How is this man going to appease his master? Halo barashay hanashimohem, only with the heads of these individuals. Halo zed David asher yanu lo v'amchalos lemor, is the same David who they said singing with the timbrels. Hikash Shaul balafov v'David barivasov. You remember that chant after Goliath?
Apparently it was a chant that was well known in the ancient world. Shaul kills thousands, David tens of thousands. What are they saying? So Malbim says, look at three. They brought the dual argument. Why did they want David? So the Manavshah. Imbar, I don't know. If he fled from his master because his master drove him away because he wasn't faithful to his master, so how can we trust him? If he's untrustworthy, so much so that Shaul himself got rid of him, so how can we trust him? He'll turn on us also. Lo yelon l'satan b'milchamo. And if in fact he himself is trustworthy, that he appeased, that if in fact he did not really go to the other side, but is a Trojan horse, so certainly he's going to now appease himself to Shaul by killing the Plishtim. So either way doesn't work out for us, the Plishtim said. Either he sincerely left Shaul, in which case he's not trustworthy, like he turned on his previous master, he'll turn on us too, or he didn't really leave Shaul, in which case he's setting us up to destroy us from within. Either way, we don't want him. That's what the Malbim says. The Barbanel has a very cute phrase familiar to us. How are you going to put the cat in charge of the mice? That's what he said. He says in the mushal that we all know. David is the cat. He killed Goliath. He's killed Plishtim for as long as he's been in battle. So you're going to put the cat in charge of the mice? Can't be. But others say, Baal Metzuda says here, something we recognize. What was their first argument? It's the bolded phrase. Mo ha'ivrim ha'ela. What are these Hebrews doing here? You could really hear the inflection. What are the Hebes? We don't want the Hebes in our midst. The aliens, the foreigners. What divrei? So the Metzuda says, came through in Yisrael. That's what Jews are called. Hebrews. Ki be'ever ha'nohar yashua l'sechem. Our forefathers dwelt on the other side of the river. The Jews are always on the other side. However you look at it. We're never... What's that?
The other side of the
river. Right, because Avram was from the one side of the river. The fact is, people are on both sides of the river. What's he talking about in a specific sense? He's always on the other side. You have the whole world, in fact, the Medrash says, the whole world is on one side, and Avram was me'ever Hashemi. And that's why we're Ivrim. However you look at it, Jews never fully assimilate themselves into the host society, even if they want to. They're always considered outsiders. And that was their complaint. However long David would be there, and however faithful he would serve Achish, nevertheless, the Plishtim hate him. The irony, of course, is that because the Plishtim hate him, David escapes having to resolve that dilemma. Achish puts him in an untenable position. Either show your faithfulness to Achish by killing Jews. David has no way out. As always, or it happens very often, the Goyim provide him a way out. It's their hatred of David and Jews generally that lead them to reject him. So therefore, he can say to Achish, as he does a few psukim later, what did I do? Here I'm serving you faithfully. But David is perceived as the outsider. I was reading a few weeks ago, I read a book, it's a very quick book, on Sandy Koufax. It was a bestseller about 2 years ago, called The Lefty's Legacy. Read the book? Read the book. Look, he wasn't the greatest Jew in the world, but there's one thing which really marks his entire career. Even though he never complained about it, he always felt held down because he was Jewish. He wasn't pitched for years, the first 4 or 5 years he was on the team. He either couldn't throw strikes or he threw shutouts, that's what it was. But he felt he wasn't given the chance. And in fact, very often they just referred to him as the Jew. Who's pitching tonight? We're giving the Jew the ball. And when he got better, even some of his teammates would say, we're okay, the big Jew is pitching tonight. However much he became part of them, he was always on the outside. That's what Ivrim Ha'ilah. And that, in a hostile sense, is how they looked at David here. And again, the irony is that it's not uncommon in our history that very often it's the hostility of our enemies that saves us either from internal strife or from having to make tough decisions one way or the other. I want to talk about it that openly. But in fact, we recognize many of the decisions that Israel has faced over the last 10 years, they've always been able to delay and sometimes rule out entirely, because at the moment of concession, there was a terrorist attack, a grievous terrorist attack that took many lives, and therefore the government was just like awakened from its slumber, and the concessions were put on the back burner. It doesn't stop them from having the will to make concessions, but it's just uncanny how at the moment at which they decide to surrender, the hands of evil are raised and Jews are killed, and then we start thinking again, we reevaluate. That's what happened to David here, and it's what happens to the Navi, we said many times, just recurs in our history again and again, and that's why it's written here, because it's an example to us. We understand the Nevi'im, we understand exactly what our history is and how we are to maneuver in the world. So what happens? Vayikra Achish El David, Achish calls David and says, Chai Hashem, Ki Yoshar Ata, as God lives, I know you're honest. As far as I'm concerned, you can come out with me to battle. I found no evil in you. But my officers, my staff is not like you. I would love to keep you around, but I can't. So therefore go. Now that David has been given his escape hatch, so now he could play Achish like a mandolin. Vayomer David el Achish, Kinel Sisi, what did I do? Mama Tzosi v'avdecha miyom asher ha'yisi l'ponecha ad ha'yom hazeh. In Pasuk Ches. Number five. Right. What did I do? What type of evil did you find in me? Kilo avo v'nilchamti be'ovei Adonai HaMelech. But I'm not going to come and fight the enemies of the king. Is he sincere? Is he not sincere? I assume that he's not sincere. But what he is telling Achish is exactly what Achish wants to hear, and he's laying the groundwork for a grievance he'll have against the Plishtim, because they wronged him, so that once he becomes king, he'll be able to exact vengeance from them. And Achish says beautiful words to David. Yadati ki tov ato ba'inai kemalach elokim. He said, you are in my eyes like an angel of God, but the Sarei Plishtim don't want you. And in fact, that is really to the credit of David. Achish Melech God sends David away very apologetically. What does David accomplish in God, in the land of the Plishtim? A Kiddush Hashem, that a Jewish leader should be perceived as Malach elokim through Achish. Achish sees David as a worthy adversary, and that, in fact, is the role of the Melech Yisrael vis-a-vis the nations of the world. He should be a symbol of honor, both of Kod Shamayim and of Kod Adam. What's happening here in a deeper sense? So look at the Abarbanel in 4, the bottom right. He says, Hine be'arti shel adavar hazeh sfalel David shami. As I explained, David was praying for such an outcome. Meaning, David was faced with this conundrum. He couldn't turn back to Israel. He couldn't turn to the Plishtim. What is the only way out? Some God-induced scenario whereby he would be able to avoid making a decision and have it made to him in a favorable way. V'nei shomai Elokim tfilaso. God heard his prayer. V'nasan b'leva plishtim she yifachadu mimenu. God put it in the minds of the Plishtim that they should be afraid of him, that they should pester Achish until David leaves. And this was of great benefit to David. First, in the sense that we'll discuss the next story with Amalek. But if you skip down a few lines, at the end we'll discuss tonight when these same Plishtim go to war against Israel. And Shaul is killed. Gamke Mashalo Hoya Ilu Nishar B'Machanim Achish. Gamke B'Mashalo Hoya Ba'Kosas Yisrael Uvaharegah Shaul Uvanov. Look how fortunate David was in retrospect that he was not present in the war which kills the Melech Yisrael on the side of the Plishtim. Sha'af al-pi she'kafi emes David yilachem klal, even though, obviously, David is not going to fight at all against Shaul. He finds some other ruse to get out. Nevertheless, he nei biyoso shom lo yimna mishiyachshu b'nei Yisrael shehu v'anashov hayu amakim bohem. It would be impossible. Word would get out that David is in the camp of the Plishtim fighting against Israel, fighting against Shaul. And that, of course, would destroy David. Vishu haragesh Shaul uvanov. Lirash machuso, and he fought and killed Shaul and his sons, so he should inherit the crown. V'shebesheker nischasei v'yoso imo b'amoro. And the entire reconciliation that David effected in the cave, so that was for show. It was a farce. So in fact, the Abarbanel says, it was all hashgacha. God saved David from this predicament, so that David should not, in fact, be on the battlefield when Shaul was killed, so he'll have no share or responsibility in the death of Shaul, nor did David have to turn against Achish, who had protected him. So in fact, David walks away from this really looking very good on all sides. And of course, we'll see in a moment, this was also the reason why David goes to war now against Amalek. David, the Hashgacha determines, is kept away from the battle with Shaul. So at the end of the day, he has no role at all in Shaul's death. Nobody blames him for Shaul's death. Shaul is killed by the arch enemy of Israel, the Plishtim. David is occupied elsewhere, and now it's known that David is the natural successor for Shaul, and he hasn't taken over the throne through the murder, the assassination of the previous king. So what happens now? That begins in number 6. Perek Lamed. David leaves, and now he finds out that to his horror, when he and his men had gone to Gath, leaving their families behind in Siklag. Siklag is a small village right on the fringes of the tribal lands of Yudah. Amalek had attacked them. Vayehi bevo David v'anashav Siklag b'yom ha-shlishi. They came to Siklag on the third day. V'amaleki fashtu el negev el Siklag v'yaku es Siklag v'yisrufu osa ba'esh. They came back to a horrific scene. They had all left their families in Siklag, their cattle as well in Siklag, while they were in Gath. When they came back to Siklag, they learned that while they had been gone, Amalek had attacked Siklag, burned the entire city. They took captive all the women, young and old, but lohenisuish, nobody was killed. They took everybody captive, prisoner. They led them off, they went away. They came to the city, the city is burnt, the property is gone, worse than Shehem, Uvnehem, Uvnasehem, Nishbu. They're all taken captive and brought back to the land of Amalek. How do they respond? Vayisa David v'ha'am asher ito es kolom v'yivku. David and everybody there, they just start to cry. They start to cry. Ad asher ein bohem koach livkos. Until they had no more strength to cry. They're distraught. Because here, really, David is on a high. The Hashgach has protected him. And now, a very rude awakening. They see that something else is afoot. That while they were gone in Gath, their families were destroyed. Ushteina Shei David Mishbu, David's two wives also captured. Achinoam and Avigail. But Tetzel le David Mod, and David was very aggrieved, very distressed. Ki Amru Ha'om le Saklo, the people ready to stone him. The soul of the people was embittered, each for his son or daughter. And David drew strength from Hashem. What happens here? It's actually a very poignant thing. For the first time in David's career, aside from his troubles with Shaul, which of course were very serious, David had made one good decision after another. But the reality of leadership is sometimes there are unintended consequences of even good decisions. For the first time, David is attacked by his men for poor leadership, for making a bad decision. Granted, you thought it was right to flee Shaul, and we were with you, but what were you thinking to leave our families, women and children, vulnerable in Siklag without any protection, either from Shaul or from Amalek? What were you thinking? David's band, as we discussed once before, were ruffians, lowlifes. They were not the higher echelon of society. So what happens here? Amruha Amusaklo, they wanted to stone him. Doesn't take much for people to turn on a leader. What does it take? One bad decision. That's it. You could have 50 bad decisions. It's like Pesach Halacha. You get 50 good Piskei Halacha people like. One time you say no, that's it. They go elsewhere. So here, Ki Amruha Amusaklo, they wanted to stone him. They were all bitter. The people turned them. So first, miscalculation. First threat to his leadership. How does he handle it? So first he cries, which is very good. It's a very human response. It's a very empathetic response because he's suffering along with them. In other words, it wasn't just a bad decision that affected others. He showed them it affected him as well. If you look at the psukim, in fact, it would seem they came upon the city which was burnt. Their families captured, and then the next pasuk naturally should have been, "Hey, included in the captives was David's two wives." But no, the Navi intersperses pasuk Dalid, "Vayisod David v'ha'om asher itos kolam vayitku." They all cried. They cried seemingly. David cried seemingly before he knew his own wives were captured. Of course, he knew nobody was there. But the point the Navi is making, David showed them he's not crying for his own loss. He's crying for their loss. So that's the first response of leaders, of leadership really, that they share the suffering. They're not remote. They're not in an ivory tower. They're not removed from the people, but they're suffering along with the people. Famous story of Reb Chaim Brisker. In the early, the first decade of the 20th century, the big fire in 1907, 1908, was a big fire in Brisk, and it burned down many of the houses. The houses in Brisk were mostly made of wood, and people were homeless. Reb Chaim lived right next to the shul, and the shul was not burned, nor was Reb Chaim's house. But the shul became a hostel for people to sleep in during the months that they were rebuilding their homes. During those months, Reb Chaim did not sleep in his house, but he slept on the floor with the people in the shul. That's the mark of leadership, empathy. If everyone is suffering, he's going to suffer also. Everyone is crying, he's going to cry too. That's what David did. But then he accessed something else. David strengthened himself through Hashem. Look at number 7. Beyond the fact that David's own wives were captured, David was very distressed because the people wanted to kill him. He worked it out to go down to battle with Achish. So because he left, Amalek came in. How could he have been so foolish to leave the void? Vayeschazek David Bashem al kol zeh hayod David mischazek atzmo lishoyim Bashem. What refuge did David take at this point? A refuge in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's David's second response? One second. The second response? Bitachon that Hashem would save him. Bitachon. The Chafetz Chaim wrote a sefer called Machne Yisrael, which was a guide to the Jewish soldiers who had been impressed into service in the Tsar's army, couldn't avoid it. So one thing that he writes to the soldiers, it's referenced here by the Mishpat Zov, is that the Iker Yeshua for a soldier in battle, the essential salvation, is Bitachon Bashem, is faith in God. Beyond all the weapons, beyond all the preparation. We actually say this every Shabbos morning in a beautiful Kapitel Tehillim, Kapitel Lamed Gimel. We know by its first words, Rananu Tzadikim Bashem. So what does David say? And basically, these words are what he's saying here. Because Amalek was very strong, and David is now weakened and depressed, and his men are turning against him. Ein HaMelech Nosho Berov Chayim. The king is not saved by a great army. Yibor Lo Yinatzel Berov Koach. The hero is not saved because of his great strength, as Goliath himself could testify. Sheker Hasus Rishua. The horse, the salvation, it's a sham. It's false. Uvarov Chaylo Lo Yimaleit. And despite its great strength, it's not going to save anyone. Hine Ein Hashem El Yereov Lam Yachalim L'chasdo. Behold, the eye of Hashem is on those who fear Him, upon those who await His kindness. Lam Yachalim L'chasdo. Latzil Mimavas Nafsham U'L'chayosom Barov. To say, rescue their soul from death, to sustain them in famine. That's exactly the message of David right here. Because he sees it's not arms, it's something else. They find the methodology, the military means to strike back at Amalek. But David by Yitzchazek, David by Hashem Elokov. David strengthened himself because he knew HaKadosh Baruch Hu would not abandon him. And when one goes into battle, in fact, when one pursues any endeavor in life with the feeling that what they're doing is correct, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to abandon them, then in fact they merit that response. And that's what happened to David here. Yes?
In the passage of hardship, it shows a little bit about the Amalek, the Amalek, the enemy of
God. Right.
Always attacks us from the people.
Yes.
And
Yes, that's very good. Amalek attacks always the stragglers. Hanecha shalim acharecha, v'ato ayefi yageya, loyer elokim. That's correct. Amalek's mode of attack is never frontal. It's always to attack the flank, the rear, where the army is most vulnerable. That's what they do. They avoid the head-on battle. It's a sign of cowardice, sometimes cleverness, but usually cowardice. They strike the weak. And in fact, that's what they did here as well. In fact, there's a bracha involved in that they did not kill anybody. They just took captives, probably knowing the exchange rate of Jewish prisoners today. It's a good deal. So what happens? David is mispalel. He calls, this you don't have in front of you, but he calls Eviasar Cohen to bring the Urim V'Tumim. He asks the Urim V'Tumim, Erdof Acharei Agadud Hazeh Asigenu, should I attack this brigade? Will I conquer them? And the Urim V'Tumim answer, yes, Benavua, Redov, Yaseg Tasig, Vatzel Tatzil. Now note, he had to ask this, not just because he wanted to know, but because at this very time, Israel is involved in another war, the war to Plishtim. So the question was, should he now go with Shaul to fight the Plishtim, or go and fight his own battle for his men, retrieve their families, and save their property? And he was told yes. David has 600 men, so the Navi says he takes 400 of them. They cross Nahal Besor. In a very interesting episode, they come upon a Na'ar Mitzri, an Egyptian boy, who had been taken captive by the Amalekites. He had escaped from them. He had not eaten in 3 days. He was starved. He said he would help them if they gave him some food. So in fact, they gave him food. And then this young Mitzri directed them to Amalek. And now we continue in Perek Lamed, Pasuk Chazayin, number 8. Vayoridehu. So this Na'ar Mitzri led them, v'hinei netushim al p'nei chol ha'aretz. In fact, they found that the Amaleki, were spread out over the earth, partying. Ochlim, mishosim, mechogegim, V'chol ha-shalo ha-gadol asher lakum eretz plishtim eretz yudra. They were having a grand old time with all the booty that they had recovered from their battles. So, they were not in a fighting mentality. David came upon them with surprise and alacrity. V'yakem David me'anesha v'yara erev l'machal ha-son. David smote them from twilight of one day till the next night, 24 hours, and he killed all of them except the lo nimlat mehem ish, ki im arba meos ish nar asher rachbo agmalim vayanusu. Only people escaped, 400 Amaleki, young Amaleki escaped, riding camels, they fled. Everyone else was killed. Vayatzel David esko asher loku Amalek, ashtein oshav yitzil David, saved all the property, saved his wives, everyone's wives. Lo nedar lohem min akatom v'yad ha-gadol v'abonim uvanos mishalol v'yad kol asher lakul lohem akol eshiv David. It's an absolute victory. Aside from the fact that it's unpleasant being in captivity, there was no lasting harm. Not a cattle was touched, not a human being was harmed. Everything was restored as it was before. So there's one very interesting dimension here. There were no survivors in Amalek except the 400. Alright, what's the 400? So look at number 10. Rashi says in Gracious, the number 400 means something to us. Alright, one fact you have to know, who is Amalek? Amalek is Esav's grandson. Okay, Esav goes to greet Yaakov. Who is with him? Arba Meos Ishimo. Esav comes with an army of 400 in Vayishach to kill Yaakov. Then Esav and Yaakov reconcile. In number 10, Rashi says, Vayosha Vayomahu Esav Ladako Seira. Esav goes back to Seir, leaves Yaakov in Eretz Yisrael. Esav Levado. What happened to his 400 men? Barbamayos Ishalchu Imo Nishmitu Me'etzo Echad Echad. The 400 men, they slipped away one by one. The 400 men disappeared. Why? So the Medrash says, Rashi quotes a snippet of the Medrash. They left because when they saw the reconciliation, in fact, they saw who Yaakov Avinu was, they said, we'll leave Shaloni Kaved B'Gachaltel Shel Yaakov. We don't want to be burned by the coals of this Tzadik Yaakov. We don't want it. This is not our fight, our battle. So they left. They left. They deserve a reward from God. V'Hechon Paralo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Where did God repay them? Here, he made David. Shememar, the only people saved, Ki Imar Bamayos Ish Nar Asher Rachavo Al Hagmalim Vayanusu. These 400. Beautiful medrash, by the way. So what's the point? Same number, 400, so therefore it's linked. Whenever you see these midrashim, there's always a thematic link that we have to try to understand. And I didn't see this written down anywhere, but it's logical to say. If you have your own thoughts, you can please share them. You see, what's happening here is when Amalek is defeated, and except for the 400, and the 400 leave, essentially duplicating what Esav did, essentially Amalek is acquiescing to David's possession of Eretz Yisrael, at least for the time being. Much like Esav acquiesced to Yaakov's possession of Eretz Yisrael for the time being too. So therefore, now that David is involved in conquest of Amalek, which is one of the major tasks of the king, one of the two tasks. The other is Binyan Beis HaMikdash. The other is to destroy Amalek. Once David is involved in the destruction of Amalek, so in fact, he's poised to fulfill, to implement Yaakov's brachos, especially the ones that he gave to Yehuda. Atoyo ducha checho. Malchus will come from Yehuda. That's the linkage. When Yaakov reigned supreme in Eretz Yisrael, it was just a prelude to the time at some distant point at which his descendant, whoever the Ben Yehuda who assumed Malchus would be, would assume the monarchy of Eretz Yisrael as well, and wage the war against Amalek and build the Beit HaMikdash too. That's the pshat. What else is happening here? So firstly, we know the basic rule of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is no chesed that goes unrewarded. No matter if we do it, no matter if the nations of the world do it. In HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekapech Schar Kol Birya. God does not withhold the reward that's due any creature. And in fact, you see, it's not accidental. But David is now engaged in one of the major functions of the king, and he's doing it in a way which completely contradicts what Shaul did. David did it without hesitation. He killed all of them. Those who escaped, they escaped not in his cheshbon, but God's business. Eventually we'll deal with them too. But not like Shaul. Shaul failed in his attempt to exterminate Amalek. David succeeds. And now you see the point of transition from the failed king to David Melech Yisrael. Yes. No, it doesn't say he left them. It says Shlom and Lach Mayhem. They fled. Yeah. Well, they couldn't. Doesn't mean he would desist. Eventually he'd get to Amalek too. But you see, not always in your hands, not always in our hands. But he did what he had to do. He waged the war, and he waged it unconditionally. Those who escaped, it's not his cheshbon, it's something else. He didn't let them live like Shaul did. They escaped. That was different. Shaul had Agag under his custody and control. He was incarcerated. So Shaul let him live. David did not let them live. They escaped. In battle, people do escape. People flee the battlefield. As we'll see in a few moments also. Something else happens here, which also, oh, again, like I said before, all these events are really hakonos, preparations, the final preparations for David as leader. And here you come across really a fascinating incident. Beginning in number 11, Pasuk Chaf Aleph. So they recovered everything. Akol Eshiv David. Vaykach David Eskol Atzon Babakar Nagu Lufi HaMikneh Ahu Bayomru Zeh Shlal David. All the people, all his men, the 400 that had traveled with him to fight Amalek, they said, this is David's spoils. Meaning they give everything to the commander. Good. Vayavod David, the assumption is he would divide this amongst the 400 who went to battle with him. What's that? That was their cattle. But that was their cattle, and then they seized all the property of Amalek too. What's that? No, that was a special command of the Navi to show to kill the cattle. We're not obligated, Mechias Amalek, to destroy their cattle. We have to, you know, give provisions to our Delta Tessics. Yes. We'll see. It's special Ashgacha. Nothing happened to them. Molech let them live. Why? They don't know, but they let them live. Whatever it was, let them live. It's hard to say. It looks like it's less than 3 months. It might even be a number of days. All right, that's why they were still partying. It had to be sometime less than 3 months. It's between 3 days and 3 months. It's probably closer to a few weeks. And you know how communication was. They didn't know about it until they got back. So, what happens now? Pasuk Chafal. So, Zesh Shlal David. Vayavod David. El Masayim Hanashim Asher Pigrumi Lechas Achrei David. David went to the 200 of his soldiers who did not fight. By Oshivum Benachal Bsor, the 200 who were too exhausted, Shepigrumi Lefes, they were too tired. They're too tired of their involvement with Achish. They set out this battle, went back to Nachal Bsor, by Tzu Lekras David, Lekras Samasher Hikos, they heard about the battle over Tziklag, they then went out to greet David. They gashed David Esome, Yeshalom B'Shalom, see, approached them and asked how they are, what's new, etc. Now, Look at this. Pasuk Chavez. Vayan kol ish ra uvliyal. It's number 11, yeah. Vayan kol ish ra uvliyal mehan ashim asher ochum David. And every mean-spirited, every lowlife who was in David's camp, who went with him, these 400 to battle, they now said to David, Vayamru, Ya'an asher lo hochui mi, lo nitein lohem me'asholo asher hitzalnu. Because these 200 did not go to battle with us, they should have no share in the spoils at all. You want to have a share in the spoils of war? You go to battle. Ki emish es ishto ves bonov v'in hagu v'elechu. They should be content to recover their wives and their children and go on their way. But we did the fighting. They stood back to recover. They have no right to anything. All right? Not an unfamiliar argument today, by the way. Vayomer David. David says to them, Lo sasuchein echoi. No, my brothers. That's not what we do. Eis asher nasan Hashem lonu v'yishmoro sonu. That which Hashem has given us, v'yishmoro sonu, He's watched over us, v'yitenes hagidud habo aleinu biyodeinu, and He delivered into our hands the band that had come upon us. Umi yishma lochem ladavar hazeh. Who could hearken to such a thing? Those who went into battle and those who remain with the baggage, with the kelim, they divide the spoils equally. From that day forth, from then until today. Well, I guess not until today, but until the time the Navi was written, that was David's decree. And that's how he ran his army. Everybody shares in battle. How could they be so grudging? These Anshei Bliyal, Anshei Ra Bliyal, these people without an oath, without a yoke, understanding of Malchus Shemayim, evil people. You have, what's that? Lola, even so, how can they be so grudging? These people had fought all the other battles with them. So you see, in fact, I mean, that's a very prevalent argument today as well. The people in Israel also don't fight. Right? Whatever reason. They're learning Torah, which I guess is a good reason. But they're also not fighting. And it engenders tremendous acrimony in society. Achechem. Your brothers go to battle and you're going to sit here. And you see, David had a different mentality. David recognized that there are many different types of contributions to Klal Yisrael that a person can make. Many different contributions. Those in the front, those in the center, those in the rear, those in logistics, those in charge of Ruach. And the Tzva Hashem needs all of them. And what underlies the principle? So look at number 12 in the Metzudos. Bottom left, Ratzuloma. V'chi b'toach yadeinu lotachnu. Can we capture all the spoils ourselves? It's our power. Halo hu es asher nasan Hashem lonu. It's all that God gave us. V'shamar osanu, and He protected us. Not a person was lost in the entire battle, even amongst the captives. God gave the band over to us. If it all comes from God, so we're all God's people. All God's people. It's a beautiful statement. I mean, how it applies to today, I'm not wise enough to tell you. But in fact, if people realize that we're all the Am Hashem, and we're all fighting the same battle, and we all wage the battle in different ways, if that's what we're doing, so what David HaMelech says is very compelling. And it's only because we are more grudging, and we only look at the battle as who is pulling the trigger on the gun, or oiling the cannons, that's really doing the fighting. If there are others doing fighting in a different way, if that's the mentality, they believe they're all part of the Am Hashem and we're serving in different ways. So you see, by Yisrael, Chokul Mishpat, Yisrael, even non-combatants share in the spoils of war, in David's wars, because they're all fighting in a different way. Alright? Again, you see, it's right out of the headlines. Yes. That's right. Well, he thought that since they would stay in Aver Hayarden, the tribes, was it Dan, Reuben, Gad, Chatashev, and Menashe, they weren't entering Eretz Yisrael, they wouldn't be involved in conquest at all, no share. So now you see, they said, no, they fight also. But that's a different opinion, because they weren't entering Eretz Yisrael. They are in Eretz Yisrael. The fact is that, you know, only a small percentage of people actually fight on the front. We don't like to look at it that way. Yeah, they were tired. They were exhausted from battle, that's all.
But weren't they all
exhausted from battle?
They were tired. They needed some R&R. Whatever, if people get tired, what are they going to do?
Everybody has a different
breaking point. That's right. They couldn't do it. They asked out. All right? And David gave them that right. You can't force a soldier who's already fatigued by battle to keep fighting. Right? You can. Right. Well, it depends. They have such a thing. What's it called? Battle fatigue. You have battle fatigue, you can't fight. So the wise commander will recognize that. But David looked at it a different way. It's a way also to ingratiate yourself to all the soldiers. There's no hierarchy in the army. Everyone is equal. Not only that, he does something else. I don't know if I copied it for you. No, I didn't. But the psukim continue. David comes back to Ziklag, and then he goes to the surrounding towns, and it mentions Beit El, Ramoth Negev, Yatir. Yatir's a little settlement today. Aroer, he goes all through the tribal lands of Yehuda, and everyone who ever helped him fight against Shaul, everyone who ever gave him any succor, any refuge, David gives them the spoils as well. Meaning, all Klal Yisrael, all Am Hashem, all part of the battle, and therefore everybody joins in it equally. Now, this of course cements David's popularity amongst these people, because during the war with Amalek that he's conducting here, Shaul dies in battle. If you just look briefly at number 9, Mishpat Azov quotes the Radak that Amalek, they were looking to attack because they knew there was property there. Look at the second paragraph. V'hakol hoya mechesed akel yisbara. Again, hashkafa. All God's kindness to David. Today shelo yavo b'tainos al David melech Yisrael shelo bala ezras amis haba milchama. People should not then say to David, where were you when Israel was getting routed on the battlefield and Shaul and his sons were being killed? Where were you? So God precipitated a battle that David would fight, a legitimate, justified battle. Ulatach tirdu b'milchama prati shelo, personal battle to save his own family and those of his men. Latzos mishpachto v'anshei shlomo uvozeh ha'on far lo hayatzorech el ha'makom Ziklag. After this, they didn't go back to Ziklag. They didn't need Ziklag. Ziklag was like a forward position for them, a temporary encampment as they were fleeing from Shaul. So it wasn't Ziklag they were fighting. But the whole war basically was a pretext to allow, from God, to allow David not to have to be on the battlefield when Shaul was killed. And that's what happens now. This war with Amalek, as I mentioned, is really the changing of the guard. Turn the page to the 16th, the top middle. From Oz Melech of Rav Ariel, Shaul yatzel milchemet Hashem b'Amalek, avol zeh yatzelo l'milchamat tzmo. Shaul went to fight God's battle with Amalek, so that became his own personal war. And from that, the spoils of that war, he stumbled. David went to a personal war, not to fight Amalek for nationalistic reasons. And that became the war against Amalek. So you really see a verse. Shaul was fighting a nationalistic war, and he turned into something personal. Fighting a war of a mitzvah, and it became subjective. David is fighting a personal, individualistic battle against Amalek. He was personally wrong, but yet he transformed that into a nationalistic battle, in fact, into the Kiyum HaMitzvah of Melchemes Hashem Ba'Amalek Midor Dor. While this is happening, as I noted, Shaul goes to battle. With this, everything comes to a head. We'll see by the end of Shmuel Aleph, the last parak, Lamed Aleph, we begin. All scores are settled. All loose ends in Shaul's life are tied up. And once again, Shaul, as he's done probably in our memory maybe 6 or 7 times, if not more, is always stretching the halachic envelope. Nothing is always clear for Shaul. He's always engaging in very marginal, questionable behavior. He did it from Amalek on. Almost every parak, something else happened. And now he dies the same way. What happens? So this begins number 16. Number 13. The Plishtim Nilchamim Yisrael, Parak Lamed Aleph. The Plishtim, Achish and company, go to fight. Vayanusu Anshei Yisrael Mepnei Plishtim. Plishtim, the Jews see the army of the Plishtim, and they are petrified. They flee the battlefield. Vayiplu Chalalim Bahar Gilboa. Many corpses are slain on Har Gilboa, right in Emek Yisrael. We just drove by it a few weeks ago. Whoops, that thing. The Har Gilboa, on the way to the north where the final battles took place. All right, the Gemara says here, look at number 14. What happens when you flee, when you retreat? Nothing good. The Gemara says in Sota, Memdalad Amad Aleph, at the bottom, goes on to Amad Bez, that if people don't want to serve in the army, Miosh Hayre Varach HaLevav, people who are preternaturally frightened, easily frightened, they should leave. B'chol HaMevakesh LaChazor HaRashus B'yardo L'Tapeach HaShokov. Whoever wants to leave the battlefield, he has the right to leave. Not like Alan's on. You have the right to leave. Shetchilas niso nefila. The beginning of defeat is retreat. When you retreat, that starts the route. And it's based on this. Shenema nos yisrael lefnei plishtim v'gam magefod v'dolo hisobom. Israel fled from the plishtim. A great plague broke out, and here it says, "Vayanusu anshei yisem of neflishtim, vayiplu chalulim." They fled, and they were destroyed. Retreat, as the linguists will tell you, is not a strategic relocation to the rear. Retreat really is surrender. It's defeat. It's a loss. It's demoralizing. There's no way you can spin it as something positive. Whether it's here, whether it's in Gush Katif, it's nothing positive. It's a victory for the enemies of Israel if it takes place. Chilas nisa nefila. The beginning of the nefila, the downfall, is flight. However you look at it, it's a victory for the enemies of Israel. So, the show. Yes, that's why they can't be on the battlefield. But that's not retreating from the battle. That's those who can't stand the rigors of the battle. They leave before. That's correct. Rather than leave on the battlefield and demoralize your fellow combatants. That's correct. Here they didn't leave before. They saw the battle start and they were frightened. And they ran away. Vayidbeku flishtim es Shaul. So many were killed. And many were killed. Shaul was left without his army. So they started focusing on him and his sons. They killed these three great sons of Shaul, including the great Yehonasan, the friend of David. And the battle bore down very heavily. It started to crunch in on Shaul. He had no escape. And the Morim Bakeshes, the archers, started firing, shooting their arrows at him. And it started to find him. He was left ever more vulnerable. Vayochel ma'od mehamorim. And he became terrified of the archers. What he was terrified about we'll discuss in a moment. Because remember, Shaul knew he would die in battle. That was the Nevuah he received. Vayomer Shaul l'Sechelov. So now we come to the great controversy at the end of his life. He says to his armor bearer, Shlof Charbecha Vidokreniva, draw your sword and you stab me with it. Meaning you kill me. Penyavo ha'arelim ha'ela, lest these uncircumcised people come, ud karuni, they'll stab me, vis aleluvi, and they'll mock me. Velo avon osei chelov kirei ma'od, and Shaul's armor bearer did not want to kill him. Melchisrael doesn't want to kill him. Vaykach Shaul esachere, vaypolalel. Shaul took his sword, and, that's the biblical phrase, he fell on his sword. Fell on his sword, attempting suicide, trying to kill himself. Vayar nosei chelov kimei Shaul. So his armor bearer saw that Shaul, doesn't mean he died here, means he was dying. Vayipol gamu al charbo vayomo simo. His armor bearer killed himself also. Vayomo Shaul shloshes bono v'nosei chelov gamkol anosho vayomu yachdov. It was a terrible rout, a debacle for the Jewish people against the Plishtim. Melech was killed. His three princes, sons were killed. His armor bearer were killed. Much of his army was destroyed as well. The Malbim says in 17 that first Vatichbad, the war bore down heavily on Shaul's upper left when he saw his three sons killed. So Shaul's spirit left him as well, and he could not continue. And then the archers, the arrows came closer and closer and started to hit him. Remember, you're armored, but nevertheless, even the armor has places that can be pierced. And that's when he asked his armor bearer to kill him. Look at Dalit. Ratzoloma, Shehen Yid Karuni Vegan Yisaluvi. He was afraid to fall into the hands of the Plishtim because they would stab him, they would play with him, and his intention was, the Malbim says, that he didn't mind necessarily living a life of torment. But either they would play with him, or they would torment him. Mock him psychologically as a captured king, and also torment him physically, torture him. But once he said they would do both stab him and mock him, then he said, Tov she'amus v'lo tzar v'kolon. Better I should die without any pain or suffering. So now we come to the question that Chazal debated since it happened. What Shaul did, was he correct? Was he incorrect? Suicide, in this context. Did he follow the Torah? Did he not follow the Torah? What do we say? So of course, as a technical matter, for bardas, a person who's saying to kill himself, is a capital crime, as paradoxical as it sounds. It violates the pasuk in the Torah, not lo tirtzach, but violates achaz dimchem l'nafsha sechem edrosh, in Noah. But God says, I will seek your blood from you. Meaning, this is our lives are given up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So how did he do that? Note, in the end, he didn't die from the suicide. He didn't, in fact, commit suicide. We'll see in a moment, in Shmuel Bey's Perek Aleph, a Ger Amaleki comes to report to David Shaul's death. So David says, how do you know? He said, Shaul was in the throes of death, and I took my sword, I killed him. So in the end, he was killed by a Molech, which is also some Midah Keneged Midah. But we'll get back to that. The death blow was given by the Ger Amaleki. The question was, though, did he do the right thing? Look at the Radak in 15, the bottom right. And of course, it's important to realize, because what Shaul did has unfortunately become paradigmatic, I say unfortunately because of our sufferings over the years of persecution, paradigmatic in many cases, we'll discuss. So he says, Ki mei Shaul yad miyadai, karov l'mishu. Get down to the third line. Shaul did not sin when he killed himself. Even the pasuk says, I'll seek your blood from you. So to the chayin, miyad kol chayin d'shem. Afal pi chayin, lo chata. Nevertheless, he didn't sin. With he shahoy yodea Shaul, he sofo hayo lamus b'milchamah. Shaul knew he was going to die in battle. Bless you. That was the Nevuah he received. Ki chayin amar lo Shmuel. Ve'od ki ra'ah ki mitzau ha'morim anashim ba'keshes. He was going to get killed anyway, not just because of the Nevuah, but because he was already struck by arrows. V'lo yacholi malet mi'adam. He couldn't escape them. Tov ha'yosh yar v'hu atzmo. V'lo yis'alu vo harelim. Bet he should kill himself, don't let the plishtim make fun of him. And that's what Chazal said in the Medrash. Achaz dimchem l'nafsho sechem edrosh. Yochol kishol. Maybe like Shaul too, he's guilty. Tamuloma ach. Ach is always a limitation. Ach distinguishes Shaul. If you look at number 19, so the says in the other day, Kotna, child kills himself, so just like Shaloba does, it can't be intentional. And adult who commits suicide, who anus kishol amelech, and he is coerced, like Shaul was. Ain monin mimeno chol davar. We don't refrain. We don't limit our velos at all for him. And the Shach comments in 20, Sukkot and Vav, Shaul amelech shehareg es atzmo lefi shirash haplishtim yasu bo kirtzonon v'yargu. He killed himself because he saw the plishtim would capture him and do with him whatever they wanted to do. Look at number 21, because in fact, the Mishpat Zav is a long discussion here, and he summarized with four reasons why Chazal justified what Shaul did. First, Shehoi Yorei Machmas HaYisurim Shiyaviruhu Al Adas. Shaul was afraid of being tortured to violate the Torah, as happens. That's such an interesting insight that Chazal have, that people would prefer to be killed than to be tortured. How do we know this? Look at number 18. The Gemara says in Ksuvos, Taflam and Gimel Medeis, Gemara says that Nisa is the most stringent of all the punishments. The Gemara asks, how do you know? Gimel Malkus Chomer, maybe Malkus is more severe than Nisa. Gemara Rav, Ilmolei Nagdua L'Chananim Yishol Azariah, Popul Salma. What an unbelievable statement. Chananya Mishol and Azariah will throw a Nebuchadnezzar to bow down to the idol, or he'll throw them in the furnace and they'll be killed. He said, you're not bowing down, kill us. They're thrown into the furnace, and miraculously God saved them. Mishon Lachanana Mishol Azariah B'Toch Kibshon Eishiganenu. We say this in the davening of Slichos, so they were saved. So the Gemara says, yeah, but if Nebuchadnezzar would have said to Chananya Mishol Azariah, bow down to the idol, or I'm going to torture you, Pochu Utsalma, they would have bowed down to the idol. People are less likely to accept torture. They plead for death rather than be tortured. He's afraid of being tortured in such a way that they would cause him to violate the Torah. And I'm surprised. I didn't do an exhaustive survey, but I looked through all the Mefarshim, and nobody references to me what would seem to be the most obvious context. Shimshon Agibar. Shimshon was captured by these same Plishtim just a century and a half earlier, less than that, and they tortured him. They gouged out his eyes. They shackled him. See, he had a horrible existence the last 2-3 years of his life. And so they don't reference it. But it wouldn't surprise me that's on Shaul's mind also. You take the Melech Yisrael, the Melech Yisrael, not just Shimshon the Shofet, the first king of Israel. So imagine what they would do to him. And Nebuch, we know that in the Middle East, that type of torture, both before death and posthumously, is quite well known. It's one of the things that they refuse to talk about in Israeli society, but if it was up to me, I definitely would, so people should know what we're dealing with. And the prisoners of war, I was told this by Rabbanim involved in the burial after the Yom Kippur War, prisoners of war returned from Syria were literally carved up. They came back in pieces. All right? And that's the type of enemy that we're dealing with. And it's no surprise that Israeli POWs never come back alive. And it's as if we just take it for granted that they were killed somehow in battle. In fact, the government says they were killed in battle, which I don't believe for a moment, the last three who returned. Most likely were tortured again and mutilated and then returned in that condition. But they won't say it because they don't want to offend the families. On the contrary, people, so the families take less offense if people knew the type of Rishon that we're dealing with. But that's what it is. That was a very valid concern. If that becomes a concern, the Chazal say it's mutter. Secondly, Shaul was afraid if he's captured, they'll mount rescue attempts. He's Melech Yisrael. And they'll have him in a secure location, and many Jews will be killed trying to save him. Can't be. Gimel, Shayori Mipnei Chil Hashem, Shisalub Mashiach Hashem. He was afraid of Chil Hashem, which is what the Radak is mentioning also. The desecration of God's name, that the Melech Yisrael, the anointed of God, should be held captive by the enemy and tormented. And finally, Shayor Batuah, the Mitzasa, the Nevoi, the Shmo, and he knew often he was dying. So it wasn't as if he had a long life ahead of him. He knew he was going to die. These four reasons are offered. They're all valid. So now that you see the accept of the halacha, so now the question becomes, how do we apply it to future events? I'll just take three cases quickly. One is Mitzada. All right. You see, for example, Mitzada, they killed themselves in the year 73, which is 3 years after the Korban. And yet Chazal never mentioned it. Josephus mentions it at length. Chazal don't mention it, because apparently, I mean, Shita Kildor, you see, they didn't approve what they did in Mitzada. You know, it's heroic as it seems to the modern secular Israeli, Chazal disapproved of it. Because if you take the mindset of the fighters of Mitzada, to its logical conclusion, there's no Klal Yisrael anymore. So they weren't being asked to surrender to face torture or even execution. They were going to be in captivity and servitude, like the rest of Klal Yisrael. Right? At the same time, they're killing themselves. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is in Yavne, rebuilding the Jewish people. So Chazal did not see suicide as an option. So that was disapproved. There's a more striking case, which became unfortunately too common in the Middle Ages, especially during the Crusades, where the motivation of the Crusaders was to kill the adult Jews, kidnap their children, and raise them as Christians. So to avoid that, Jews killed their children before killing themselves. So this is taken up in number 22, in the Mishpat HaZoh. Yidiyan Shel Shlomo Harich Binyan Yidin to Ritva. The Ritva mentions another case in the Gemara from Hanani ben Trajo, Bruria's father, who was being tortured by the Romans, one of the Saruger Malchus, and the Romans had put moist tufts of wool around his heart to delay his death and set him on fire, wrapped in a sefer Torah. And he asked one of the Romans to remove the tufts of wool to allow him to die quicker. So he did, and he said he's going to share an olam haba, and then he died. So then the question is, was he allowed to hasten his death? So you see that Tosis mentions, where a person is afraid that they will not force him, or there should be, they will force him to violate the Torah. In our classic case, Rabbeinu Tam is Rashi's grandson, living during the period of the Crusades. Your person is allowed to harm himself. Umikan lomdim, listen to these words, and we should tremble reading them. Umikan lomdim lishchot hane'arim b'gzera mifnei havaras hadas. From these cases of Shaul, of Hanani ben Trajon, we see that you're allowed to shech the child in order to avoid having him fall into the hands of the Christians and raise a non-Jew, because this way, zoch l'chayel mabah. I remember many years ago, I was studying. What's that? It's arguable. I can tell you the extent. I remember when I was younger, we were going to this area in Yeshiva, and we came across a tshuva, I forget who, But the Jews at the time asked, what bracha do you make before you kill your child? You make a bracha al hashchita, which is the bracha you make before you shecht an animal, or the bracha kiddush Hashem, the tzivan or kaddish mo barabim. They discuss in Rishon, imagine the world we're living in. Discuss in Rishon, what's the bracha to make? But the Ritva said, based on that, you see that there were no heg. You're correct. There's no chiyuv, but it was done numerous times. And then he says that the Ritva writes that he found the Gilyone Hashas that it's not necessarily so. Ela Kitzvar Hora Zaken is already paskin, and people follow this. The Shemana B'Shem Gedolet Tzarfas Sheitiru Bo Halacha L'Maisel. But the Gedolim in France did permit it, and that's where it was most common, France and Germany. But the Yamshel Shlomo was in Poland a little later on. He says, the Reed disagreed, and the Reed said, you can't do it. And the Rush also, the Rush went from Germany. He fled Germany, spent his later years in Toledo, which at the time, in the 14th century, was a much more hospitable place for Jews. He said also, the only heter is to allow yourself to be killed. But to take your own life, that you can't do, and shol is shol, but for us to do it to our children, you can. So in that case, machlokas, but you see, in fact, that many Jews did it. And they did it relying on rabbinic authority, that if a person is going to be forced into apostasy, the better he should die, kill oneself, even kill one's child. The other case, of course, you found in the Holocaust, where it happened many times. People would throw themselves at electrified fences. And again, that really is more akin to Sheol than it is to Mitzvah. Because they are talking about enduring tremendous, relentless suffering with no end in sight, with the likelihood of death anyway to come. So therefore, it was done. You look in the treatise of the time that came out, whether it was permissible halacha, so you could argue both sides. That since that's what the enemy wanted, that we should die, why give it to them? Ultimately, there are people who thought of doing it and who did not do it, but persevered, who wound up living and fathering children and grandchildren. So, who knows? It's a tough decision to make. People gave their children away. That's right. You see, the Holocaust, we may discuss it in April, I don't know if so, but the Holocaust generated a whole slew of tshuvos that really were at odds with the tshuvos of almost a millennium, 1,000 years. Because, for example, it's also to pose as a Christian. And yet during the Holocaust, like you say, not only did people pose as Christians, they gave their children to monasteries. Most never recovered, as we know.
Most
were not. I think 25% were. The church allowed 1 in 4 to be released. They kept 3 out of 4. So, they do the right thing, the wrong thing? So one of the arguments that were made during the Holocaust is that she's talking about a shmad in which the desire of the enemy is to convert the Jews, and if we don't acquiesce to the conversion, they'll kill us. So then we can understand why you can't pose a Christian if that Kiddush Hashem. But if the goal of the enemy is not to convert Jews, but just to kill every possible Jew, regardless whether they're a Christian, whether they're the grandson of a Jew, and they're already a third or fourth generation Christian, if the whole goal of the Oyev, of the enemy, is to kill the Jews, to deprive Jews of life, then you have to look at the halachic equation a different way and say, if all they want to do is kill Jews, so whatever we do to facilitate that, we're playing into their hands. So therefore, we should be allowed to use any type of mechanism in order to save ourselves. All right, I don't want to get into details now. We'll save it for a future time. But that's basically, you see, the questions, some of them at least, which arose out of this incident of Sheol HaMelech, because Sheol becomes, and his manner of death becomes symbolic, and really referenced Ledavonenu too many times by Jews who were escaping the clutches of evil. What's the aftermath? So again, nothing with Sheol is ever clear-cut. The Jews flee. Sheol's body is seized and brutalized. Continuing in the Pesukim, it's Peretz Ches. Vayehi mimocharos, just as Shaul anticipated, zema shekara. Vayehi mimocharos, this is number 13, right in the middle. Yeah, it's about eight lines up from the bottom, nine lines up. So the next day, vayavo plishtim lefashekes hachalolim, the plishtim came to plunder the corpses. Vayemtzu Shaul v'shloshes banov noflim bahar gulboa, came across a treasure. King of Israel, three princes. Vayichrasu es rosho, they chopped off his head, Shaul's head. Vayafshitu es kelov, they stripped him of his gear. Vayishalchu beretz plishtim saviv lubaser beis asabem v'yasaom, and they sent messengers all the lands of the plishtim to call a yomtiv in the Beis HaAvodah Zarah, because here they have the king of Israel. The houses of idolatry were all activated. The special services were held to celebrate the great victory, the degradation of the king of Israel. They took his gear in the temple in Ashtaros. And they hung his body in Beit Shan. They hung his head in one place, one temple. They hung his body in another place. But in Divrei Hayomim, it says they took his head to Beit Dagon. So Beit Dagon is where Shimshon was taken to be mocked. And Beit Dagon is where the Aron HaKodesh had been taken, and Dagon kept falling. So Chazal said that's why they took his head there, because they wanted to show that now their idol has triumphed. And here's the head of the king of Israel. So why does it say here Beit Shan, and there it says Beit Dagon? So you see what's happening. His head, Rahman al-Islam, is on tour. It's going from temple to temple, from Beis HaAvodah Zarah to Beis HaAvodah Zarah, throughout the lands of the Plishtim, to mock what's happening. So Shaul's body is brutalized, like I said, much like the barbarians of today who do the same thing to Jewish bodies. So there's no greater symbol of Jewish defeat and of Chil Hashem, terrible Chil Hashem. If you look at number 23, again in the Malbim, in Pasuk Yud, they took to Beis Ashtar's Beis HaAvodah Zarah, his head to Beis Dagon. Alright, Ratzu Lahazkir al Shenichras Rosh Dagon the Sibas Aron Elokei Yisrael. Like I mentioned, what were they doing? Because in the Dagon, their idol, had kept falling over from the presence of the Aron HaKodesh. The story, the beginning of Shmuel Aleph with Eli and his sons. And therefore, the Ineata Rosh Malkoma Nichras Nimtza Beis Dagon. And now the head, the severed head of the king of their enemies, is hanging in the same house. So this is their triumph, a ghoulish triumph. Who steps up? Well, we go back now to the very beginning of the story of Shaul. What's the first act that he did? The very first act, you remember that Amon was about to wage war against Yavesh Gilad. Shaul had been anointed by Shmuel, but nobody knew about it. And Shaul steps up, and he says to the residents of Gilad, in number 24, it's Parak Yud Aleph, Pasuk Tes, V'amru l'malachim haboim, kos somrun l'ish Yavesh Gilad. Shaul tells the messenger, go tell the people of Yavesh Gilad, machar t'yelachem tshuah kechol mashemesh. Tomorrow, at high noon, that's when you have salvation from Amon. They went back to Anshei Yavesh, Vayismachu, and they rejoiced. The men of the residents of Yavesh Gilad, so they wait, and now they reward Shaul for what he had done for them. Pasuk Yudal, Vayishmu Elov Yoshvei Yavesh Gilad, Eith Asher Asuf L'Shim L'Shaul. The residents of Yavesh Gilad heard what they did to Shaul, carved up his body, scattered it about the various towns and houses of idolatry. All the strong men, the daring men of Yavesh Gilad, they traveled all night and they went from town to town. They took Shaul's body, the bodies of his sons, Mechomas Beit Shan. Vayvoh Yovesha, they took it back to Yovesh. Vayisrafu Osam Shom, there they buried it. Vayikuas Atmoseihem, they took the bones of Shaul and his sons. Burned it. Now, Vayikuas Atmoseihem, they grew Tachas Oeshu B'Yovesha. They then took the bones and they buried it under the tamarisk tree in Yovesh. Vayitzumu Shivas Yomim. They fasted for 7 days. What's that? So the Gemara says, Sorkin al hamilochim velomi darke hamori. The body has apparently decomposed already. So the halacha is that it's not considered a non-Jewish form of worship, even though it's common in the non-Jewish world. Whatever belongs to the king, they burn, including the king. As a matter of fact, that's the Minagat Hayom in India. That's correct. When somebody dies, they're apt to burn the widow along with him. Not just the possessions of the person, called the funeral pyre. Cuts down, you know, on second marriages, I guess, in India. But that's the ancient custom, and you said Malchus saw the same thing. Usually they'll burn their Caleb, all right, not their bodies, of course. But apparently his body had been so desecrated here that there was nothing left to do. Shaul dies, and it's interesting that he dies really having atoned for all his sins. Everything is connected at the end. His relationship with David is squared away, and David is shielded from the battle. There's no role in the death of Shaul. Yavesh Gilad, he has the opportunity to pay him back. Shaul and Amalek, his great sin, it's also atoned for. They noted earlier, who kills him? So look at number 25, which is already in Shmuel Beis. This Nar Amaleki comes to David with a report of the battle. Eich yadata ki mei Shaul v'yonosan b'no. How do you know Shaul Yonosan died? The Omer li miata. As he said, who are you? He said, Amaleki anochi. I'm an Amaleki. And then, as the Navi continues, Vayomer Eli, it's Pasuk Ches. Ches. Amod Nolai. Shaul said to me, stand up over me. Umosaseni, kill me. Kiachazani Hashavats. Because the throes of death have come upon me. Kicholod Nashidi, as long as my soul is within me. Vamod Alov, Vamosaseu. Kiadati, Kilo Yichiachere, Niflo. So I stood over him and I killed him. Because I knew he could not survive, and as I took his crown, here's his crown, and I'm bringing it to you, Master David. We'll see, David kills him, but in fact, who killed Shaul in the end? Anar Amaleki. So they say, Mida Keneged Mida. Everything is settled in the end. Everything is atoned for in the end. Shaul HaMelech, he was a great individual. All his sins are atoned at the end. What he did with David, Amalek, Shmuel, everything that he did, very hard to understand. Like we said last time, he was always on the precipice of violating the halacha. Sometimes he stepped over the line even. He wasn't always rational, but at the end of the day, he's considered a tzaddik. And look at number 26, the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, Parsha Nun Dalet. Avram and Avimelech exchanging the 7 kvasos. So God says, you gave the king of the Plishtim 7 sheep. Believer Tzoni, Chayecha Keneged Kain Orgim Min Bonecha Shiva Tzadikim. A Plishtim will kill 7 righteous people. Chofni, Pinchas, the 2 sons of Eli. Shimshon, Shaul, Shoshes Banav. Shaul and his 3 sons are all considered righteous. Shaul dies at Tzadik because in fact he ends his life, the first king of Israel, having his sins atoned for in the battlefield. There's no doubt also the way he was treated after death, mistreated after death, is also part of the kapara. So, thus ends the life of Israel's first king. It's complicated and tragic and flawed, but in fact, Shaul ends a giant. He served his people and really prepared us for the real Malchus. The real Malchus is not Malchus Shaul, it's not Malchus Binyamin, it's not Malchus Rachel. The real Malchus is Malchus Leah, really Malchus Yehuda, and Malchus David Melch Yisrael, Chai V'Kayom, which we start entertaining next time. Okay. All right, I thank you all for coming. I went a little long because...